Julian Assange makes a plea deal to get out of jail.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange will plead guilty to a felony charge in a deal with the U.S. Justice Department.
UN Chief Antonio Guterres accuses Israel of spreading misinformation about him.
I've heard the same source many times saying that I never attacked Hamas, that I never condemn Hamas, that I am a supporter of Hamas. I asked for a statistic to be made by our colleagues.
And celebrity chef Rachel Ray's charity work for Ukraine.
You can keep them in your mind and on your lips and in your heart.
Today is Tuesday, June 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. A major development in the case of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. He's due to plead guilty to violating U.S. espionage law in a deal that will end his imprisonment in Britain and allow him to return home to Australia, ending a long legal odyssey. More now from Associated Press correspondent Haya Panjwani.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange will plead guilty to a felony charge in a deal with the U.S. Justice Department that will resolve a long-running legal saga over the publication of a trove of classified documents. Assange is scheduled to appear in the U.S. federal court in the Mariana Islands, a U.S. commonwealth in the Western Pacific, to plead guilty to an Espionage Act charge. Prosecutors have agreed to a sentence of the 5 years Assange has already spent in a high-security British prison while fighting to avoid extradition to the U.S. to face charges. I'm Haya Panjwani.
Assange was indicted during former President Donald Trump's administration over WikiLeaks' mass release of secret U.S. documents which were leaked by Chelsea Manning, a former U.S. military intelligence analyst who was also prosecuted under the Espionage Act. The charges against Assange sparked outrage among his many global supporters who have long argued that Assange, as the publisher of WikiLeaks, should not face charges typically used against federal government employees who steal or leak information. Among them, Cindy Cohn, executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Regardless of what this means for Mr. Assange, it's terrible for the United States. This prosecution should not have happened. This is the first time in the 100-year history of the Espionage Act that a journalist or someone committing journalism, someone engaging in journalistic act, has been prosecuted under the Espionage Act for essentially receiving information and communicating information. And this is something that journalists do all the time.
Assange is due to be sentenced to 62 months of time already served at a hearing on the island of Saipan at 9 a.m. local time on Wednesday. That's 2300 GMT on Tuesday. He's expected to return home after the hearing. The EU begins formal accession talks with Ukraine on Tuesday. It's taken more than 10 years to reach this point. Here's Reuters' Alex Cohen with a look back at the long trek to this day.
Ukraine is Europe, chanted these supporters of closer ties with the European Union in 2013. Now, more than a decade later, the country will begin talks to join it. Ukrainian serviceman Yehor Sobolev has backed the effort since those 2013 demonstrations.
For me, it's about fulfilling one's dreams. Sometimes it is very hard to fulfill your dreams.
The launch of talks, though largely ceremonial, is an important step for a nation that has spilled blood and pushed through the reforms required in its pursuit of EU membership. Ukraine filed its request to join the EU days after Russia's full-scale invasion in February 2022. Ukraine cleared initial hurdles to accession in December by showing progress in fighting corruption and rebuilding its judiciary. The negotiations with the EU are expected to take years to conclude.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. So let's talk more about this. Joining us now is Amy Verdun, a professor of political science at the University of Victoria. All right, so let's start with the big picture. This is a long time coming, yes?
Yes and no. So I think for Ukraine, it was something they had been hoping for way longer than the EU was hoping for it to happen. And the full-scale war in Ukraine changed that, that also the EU could see how this was strategic for the EU. And in that sense, it was, you know, coming up in a speedier fashion just in the since the February 2022 changes geopolitically.
What is it going to mean for, and it, well, there's still a long way to go, right? This could take a
couple of
years.
Oh, absolutely. Very long time to go, yeah.
What does Ukraine have to do in that time period?
So Ukraine is like all other member states who are aspiring member states who are interested in joining. They need to change a lot of laws in many different areas. And so they will need to do all of the changes in their domestic law so that by the time they join the EU, they would meet all the rules and regulations that the EU has in place. And what they typically do is they set up negotiations for each of the chapters. They call them negotiation chapters on things like agriculture and on single market and on all kinds of particular topics. And they negotiate chapter by chapter. And once they've closed the chapter, then they say that part is ready. And then the remainder is on the next chapters.
So I assume this is so that they mesh with the machinery that is the EU so that all of the EU countries are playing by the same production distribution rules?
Well, I would put it slightly different because the way you've described it sounds like industry and the way that people do their economy. Whereas the EU works on the rule of law and a legal basis. And so there are laws where the EU sets a framework and then member states have to implement those laws. Some laws are directly applicable to member states and other laws, they are told you need to do something like this. And then there's a bit of space for the member state to make their laws. But all those legal provisions have to be in place.
Give me an example of something that Ukraine might have to do to conform.
Yeah. So one of the things that Ukraine was weak at before the whole-scale invasion was in the area of corruption. And so if you look at statistics of levels of corruption in countries, Ukraine was in the lower echelons of not such a good record. And so in order to be part of the EU, those records have to be improved.
What is this? So if Ukraine does everything that they need to do and they do become a member of the EU, what does it mean for them?
If you're a member of the EU, you're a member of the single market. So that's free movement of goods and services and capital and labor. It also means that they're part of the funds that the EU disperses. That means in the area of agricultural policy, that's one of the biggest investments that the EU makes in its member states. So Ukraine could expect to also receive funds for its vast agricultural production.
They are a huge agricultural producer, right? The wheat particularly?
Absolutely. They also have a large piece of land, so they will be larger than France when they enter. And that could also geopolitically be interesting, because then the EU, as we know it, will have shifted to the east. And the EU is sensitive to sizes of countries, usually focusing on numbers of peoples, but also the size of the country and its implication geopolitically.
It's funny. I don't think people here in the United States realize how big Ukraine is land-wise.
Exactly.
Big country.
Ukraine is larger than France, Spain, and Germany.
And that'll change the dynamic, right, of the...
Yeah. I mean, I'm from Canada, right? So I live in Canada at this time. And so Canada is a huge, large country and nobody really cares, right? Because we don't have a lot of people and our economy is not that strong. But there are moments in time when the sheer size of your landmass matters. And within the EU context, the things that really matter is the number of people or the size of your economy. So that your country is large is not, in a day-to-day sense, crucial, but there are moments when it really matters. Yeah.
And why does it matter to the EU?
So, you know, we always think about relative power in funny ways. So we think of relative power as GDP per capita. So how wealthy are you? Do you have per population? If Ukraine comes in, the EU will not be wealthier. In fact, it will be poorer because a poorer country comes in. So Europe as a whole, per person, will become poorer. But you will have more Europeans, more EU citizens. So as a total population, it will increase. And its size will increase. If you just look at the landmass of Europe, it's not actually very large. And so if suddenly you've added a significant amount of territory, in terms of its geographical coverage of the space of the Earth, it's become bigger. Right? So these little things matter depending on the context of what it is you're talking about. And as we mentioned about agriculture, it does have a lot of potential to make a huge impact on agriculture. And agriculture is something that you spend a lot of money on. So those things will differ. We'll have to see how it all shakes out and exactly when Ukraine will join. After all, Turkey was negotiating with the EU starting two decades ago. They never got there. So we don't know if Ukraine will join. It's just that they're on that trajectory. And at this point in time, it looks as if the EU is serious and may be able at some point even to take Ukraine in when it doesn't quite meet everything, but they'll anticipate changes and they'll do already joining a little bit on this topic and not on that topic. And that would be new if they do that, but we don't know that for sure.
Excellent. Thank you so very much for the time.
Okay, you're welcome.
Amy Verdun, a professor of political science at the University of Victoria. We're following these other stories from around the world. A Delhi city minister has started an indefinite hunger strike to demand more drinking water for India's capital, where taps in some of its poorest neighborhoods are running nearly dry in the middle of a searing heat wave. Millions of Indians face water shortages every summer when the water demand rises in farms, worse this year because of the heat. Canada said on Monday it's considering whether or not to impose tariffs on China-made electric vehicles as it looks to align itself with allies against what they see as a heavily subsidized Chinese industry. French President Emmanuel Macron told a podcast episode on Monday that both the far-right National Rally Party and the left-wing New Popular Front Coalition, frontrunners in the parliamentary elections, risked bringing civil war to France. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, U.S. presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump meet Thursday for a debate. War in Ukraine is expected to be one of the top foreign policy questions. VOA's Tatiana Voryshko looks at how the two candidates differ in their approach to Ukraine.
Joe Biden and Donald Trump both agree on the need to end the war in Ukraine, though foreign policy experts say Trump has been less specific about how to make that happen between Russian leader Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Sergey Kudelya is an associate professor of political science at Baylor University.
He advocated only for the need to start some types of talks or negotiations, and he said that he would be willing to engage in these negotiations between Putin and Zelensky, but he never expressed any or specified any of the designs or the future outline of this peace agreement.
In this year's congressional fight to pass Ukraine aid, Trump said that assistance should be loans and not grants.
We're thinking about making it in the form of a loan instead of just a gift. We keep handing out gifts of billions and billions of dollars.
Trump says Europe should pay a greater share of helping Ukraine. But if reelected, Trump will not want to be seen as having lost that war, says former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, John Herbst.
We do know that Trump perceives himself as a strong man, does not want to be associated with foreign policy failure. And a Russian victory in Ukraine, if Trump is president, would look very much like a foreign policy failure.
Trump's Republican Party is split over Ukraine, with some leaders viewing the war as a major U.S. security threat, and others saying it is a costly distraction.
Russia, for many of members of the Republican foreign policy establishment, is viewed as a declining power, and hence the Russian-Ukrainian war, from their standpoint, is a conflict that needs to be settled as quickly as possible, so that it does not drain the security resources of the United States.
As president, Biden leads the international coalition coordinating military assistance to Ukraine with more than $175 billion in U.S. aid. He says America will stand against unjust and unprovoked aggression for as long as it takes.
If the United States walks away, it will put Ukraine at risk. Europe is at risk. The free world will be at risk, emboldening others to do what they wish to do us harm.
Biden has partially removed restrictions on Ukraine using U.S. weapons against military targets in Russia. That commitment means the policy of a second Biden term would likely mirror the first, with greater latitude for increasing economic pressure on Russia, says Catholic University of America professor Michael Kimmage.
It's not as if they're determining their foreign policy on the basis of the election in some crude fashion, but there are limits and constraints, and those would be very different in a second term where, you know, Biden can no longer run for re-election in 2028, and so he would be quite a bit freer.
The candidates' differences over Ukraine reflect their differing approaches to Russia, with Trump looking to improve ties with Moscow and Biden continuing to isolate Russia over its invasion of Ukraine. Tatiana Voroshko, VOA News, Washington.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. A friendly warning for Israel by Germany's Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock on Monday.
These images from Gaza are traveling the globe, sparking strong emotions in the Arab world, but also in the US, in Europe, in my country, everywhere. Disbelief, sadness, anger. And as a friend of Israel, I want to be frank. This anger is not helping Israel to meet its security needs. To the contrary, it only serves Hamas' cynical drive to provoke further escalation.
At the United Nations, Secretary General Antonio Guterres accused Israel on Monday of spreading misinformation about him.
Member states have a vested interest in not promoting misinformation, because sooner or later, the truth is discovered. I'll give you one example of misinformation about myself. I've heard the same source many times saying that I never attacked Hamas, that I never condemned Hamas, that I am a supporter of Hamas. I asked for a statistic to be made by our colleagues. I have condemned Hamas 102 times, 51 of them in formal speeches, the others in different social platforms. So, I mean, the truth, in the end, always wins.
Israel accused the UN of being biased against it. Kenya is finally sending police officers to Haiti.
On Friday, the Kenyan government announced the first MSS mission personnel contingent will arrive in Port-au-Prince during the week of June 24. They will depart Kenya tomorrow, June 25th. This is just the first of several milestones in the process to restore security and prosperity in Haiti.
State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller. And finally, Rachel Ray has been a celebrity chef with a national TV show in the United States. She has a line of cookware and cookbooks and so on. And now she spends a lot of time working for and working in Ukraine. Here's Omilian Ashulak with the story.
Let's give it a shot.
Rachel Ray has millions of followers on social media, a handful of Emmy Awards, as well as appearances in top U.S. TV shows and animated films. During the COVID-19 pandemic, her house burned down and her dog died. She went to get another rescue from a shelter.
The lady who was training my dog was the sister of a gentleman that worked with Andriy.
730 days.
Andriy Futey is president of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. In the summer of 2022, he brought Ray to Ukraine for the first time.
She herself purchased over 10,000 individual first aid kits that went to the front lines to our boys and girls there.
She's now an ambassador of the Unbroken National Rehabilitation Center in Lviv. Ray remembers when she met the Stepanenko family, who suffered from a Russian missile strike at the Kramatorsk railway station.
It overwhelmed me that a little girl could say, "Hey, do you like my earrings?" And she has no limbs. She's sitting on the bed, and her mom has one leg, and her grandmother was destroyed, blown up in front of her. Her grandmother's dead. And her little brother's sitting on the bed next to her. Her mom's over here. All of them in one room, and they're just so grateful and happy to be alive.
Since then, Ray has brought culinary equipment and medical supplies to Ukraine, as well as held workshops in orphanages and hospitals during her every visit.
I read a bunch of Ukrainian recipes, and I kind of made my own concoctions. We always do demonstrations and chats and fun things when we're here. But the reason we're at the facilities, we're building out a kitchen there that will serve 4,000 beds three times a day.
During her latest visit to Ukraine,
I tell people all the time, if you can't go yourself to Ukraine, or you can't give a lot of money to Ukraine, you can, and it's free, you can keep them in your mind and on your lips and in your heart. And that's what everyone in the world should be doing that believes in democracy.
Ray hopes to return to Ukraine in the fall of 2024. This will be her seventh visit. Omeliano Shudlyak for VOA News, Lviv, Ukraine.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform, on our apps, and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Civil society in China received another blow in June when two activists were sentenced to harsh prison terms after being found guilty of subversion against the state. Independent journalist and women's rights defender Huang Shuiqin, who was a prominent voice in the Me Too movement in China and who also reported on protests in Hong Kong, was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Labor rights activist Wang Xianbing, who advocated for workers with occupational diseases and physical disabilities, was sentenced to 3 years and 6 months. The two were tried together in secret after being held in pretrial detention for almost 1,000 days. In a written statement, State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said the United States condemns the unjust sentencing of Huang and Wang. He noted their lengthy pretrial detention and their trial closed to journalists and to the public. These sentences demonstrate the PRC's continued efforts to intimidate and silence civil society, he declared. We urge the PRC to immediately release Huang and Wang, as well as other individuals unjustly detained for exercising their fundamental freedoms, said spokesperson Miller. The number of such individuals remains unknown, but the PRC is recognized, as the non-governmental organization Freedom House has said, to be a global leader in such detentions. The first paragraph in the State Department's most recent human rights report on China under the category of arbitrary arrest is both telling and grim. Authorities detained or arrested persons on poorly defined allegations of revealing state secrets, subversion, and other crimes to suppress political dissent and public advocacy. Any piece of information could be retroactively designated a state secret, such as information on criminal trials, commercial activity, and any government activity. Authorities also used vaguely worded charges of picking quarrels and provoking trouble broadly against many civil rights advocates. A counter-espionage law granted authorities the power to require individuals and organizations to cease any activities deemed a threat to national security. State Department spokesperson Miller said, "We continue to call on the PRC to live up to its international commitments and to respect the human rights of all persons, including freedom of expression and fair trial guarantees. We also urge the PRC to accept the many recommendations made this year during the PRC's Universal Periodic Review of its human rights record."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.